But I think in the back of my mind, really, I was more focused on where I was going to live and where I was going to do once I turned 18 and aged out. So I actually saw college more as a way of secure housing for myself than anything else.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, one woman's journey from foster care to the judicial bench. In the early 1980s, a civil war in El Salvador was ravaging the country. Fearing for their lives, Xiomara Torres and her family fled. In the United States, her family settled in East Los Angeles. But at the age of 13, Xiomara found herself in the foster care system. She never lived with her parents again. Xiomara put herself through college and law school. She specialized in family law. And in 2017, she was officially appointed Circuit Court Judge of Portland, Oregon. So, for this episode of How I Made It, Xiomara Torres reflects on growing up in foster care homes and her journey to becoming a judge.
My name is Xiomara Torres. I am a Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge in Portland, Oregon. My calling really was representing children in court, so it seemed to somehow made my way back to that original purpose. In my childhood, I grew up in this town called Paraíso, and it was the very beginning of the civil war in El Salvador that ended in 92. I didn't really understand what was going on, but I knew that we were sent home a lot because soldiers would show up to the school. So something was going on. It's hard as a child to really understand what's going on. My father worked for the government. One day, I learned my father had to leave the country. So I knew he had to leave right away, and he did. And then later, we were to join him. And what I remember is us packing up, and we flew to Mexico City first. And then from Mexico City, we met with the coyotes there, and they helped us into the country. What I remember the most is arriving at a hotel room in Tijuana. I think we waited maybe half a day. And then after that, I think I was by myself and not with the rest of my family. And we were in a car with a couple, an American couple, Caucasian couple, who was going to drive the vehicle into the border and cross the border. What I remember is I wasn't supposed to talk. And so I was supposed to just be really quiet. I was with strangers, and they were helping me somehow, and that I just wasn't supposed to say anything. And that's how I entered the country. And then once I was in the United States in Los Angeles, I reunited with my siblings and my mother, and we reunited with my father who had been here. It felt comfortable in that it was a lot of Latinos, and so I heard Spanish a lot. And this was East Los Angeles. And so in that regard, it felt somewhat normal and home because of the Spanish. But once I went to school, that was different because everything in school was in English. In terms of who I made friends with, I mostly made friends with people who spoke Spanish because that's the only language I spoke. The difficulty was trying to understand the teachers who were mostly English-speaking, trying to understand the subject matters. It was really hard to understand what was going on, is what I remember. I think when I look back, definitely my parents really wanted us to assimilate, really wanted us to speak the language. They really encouraged for my siblings and I not to speak Spanish to each other and really speak English and acquire the language as quickly as possible. I did experience abuse a few years into coming into this country, and at the age of 13, I told a really good friend of mine what was happening, and she encouraged, and her family too, encouraged me to talk to the school counselor. And when I spoke to the school counselor, who was a mandatory reporter, apparently the police were contacted. And so I was in a police car shortly thereafter, and the police were picking up my siblings at different schools. I have two older siblings. I was fortunate in that I had a very skilled emergency foster home with support in that home as I was maneuvering this new system. So this particular home that I was in, they had their own children and they had been foster parents for long-term placements and they had adopted one teenager. So they had the space to take three girls for a short period of time. And I think I was there maybe a month and a half, maybe a month. After that, I moved into a home with foster parents and they had another foster child in the home and my eldest sister and I were in that home together. I think it's very difficult when you're in foster care, too, because you don't have a lot of information. And so I didn't really know most of the time how my siblings were doing. You know, at the time, I was making allegations of sex abuse. And so they must have made an assessment and made decisions about whether girls could go back home or not. And I know that I, for myself, was specifically saying I didn't want to go back home. That certainly, as the court was looking at reunification efforts with my family, they were hearing from me. And so then it's the court trying to figure out at what point you can, if possible, reunite children with their families. In terms of aging out, I had seen my sister trying to figure out, my eldest sister trying to figure out what she was going to do when she turned 18. So I already knew that was in my future, and I was trying to figure it out. I had really studied a lot, and so I was fortunate enough to have really good grades because I sort of applied myself in school as a way to escape everything else that I was going through. And so I received a letter from Berkeley recruiting me to their school. But I think in the back of my mind, really, I was more focused on where I was going to live and where I was going, what I was going to do once I turned 18 and aged out. So I actually saw college more as a way of secure housing for myself than anything else. But I think I was feeling a sense of adventure and I wanted to explore. And I think it probably inside I just was trying to get as far away from my experience as possible. College, I think, is hard, but college for foster children, first of all, they don't, you know, we have such a low percentage of foster children that attend college, but not having familial support, particularly during the holidays, was really tough. I struggled towards the second year. I dropped out for a few years, and I didn't really know if I was going to go back or not. But somehow I found my way back, and after about a three-year break, finished up. So I graduated from Berkeley, and I worked at a law firm in downtown San Francisco. As I was trying to figure out what practice area was going to be the best fit for me. The Oregon Department of Justice is really the biggest law firm for the state of Oregon, and I felt really fortunate to work there, and particularly as a minority. I knew it was a difficult position to get, and it was really important for me to work there because I really felt that the Department of Justice needed to have lawyers who looked like the community. I could see people looking at me when I was coming in a suit. I had little carry-ons with very large files when I was there to do trials. I got used to people just looking. I knew that I stood out. I think when I became a judge and I asked the governor's office in the press release, I told them it was really important for me to put in that I was an immigrant and that I was a foster child. Before that, a lot of people didn't know that I was a foster child growing up. It was a very private part of my life, and so no one really knew. I think a lot of people were very shocked to learn that I had been in care. One of the things that I do see and have seen where I can make an impact is I'm able, when children show up to court, sometimes they come to their court hearings, and seeing kids who are very quiet and don't really want to talk about a possible new placement that they just landed at, I do share with them that I was in foster care and that I was in different placements so that they know that I understand what that new environment is like for them and them readjusting. So that's sort of one way I get them to talk to me about how things are going in their new placements. And I think that's where I've seen a big difference for me. I sort of look for certain things when I'm reviewing cases. For example, I know that you very rarely saw doctors as foster children, and so I'm always looking to see when children last went for a checkup or dental care. I'm looking at grades very carefully because I know that as you move around and children are trying to readjust to schools, I know that it's very easy to fall behind in school, so I'm always looking to see. And so I'm looking at the things that I suspect maybe aren't getting the attention that they need to get. And so I'm asking about those things in my cases in my court. I, as a community member, have been attending Teatro Milagro, Miracle Theater here for many years, over 10 years. I have taken my children there. And so when I took the bench, their artistic director, Danielle Milan, had read a profile that the local paper had done on me and decided she wanted to make a play. So she reached out to me and asked me if I would allow my story to be used for that. It's an incredible honor to have a play done about you. It was also a very surreal experience for me to have your life played out on stage. Being a foster child is something that children are ashamed of and you don't talk about. As I mentioned, I didn't really share that with a lot of people, even as a grown-up. Only my closest friends knew. So I think it's so important for children in school to learn about the experience of a foster child. I'm hoping they have a greater understanding of what that experience is like, the adjustment, the estrangement from siblings. And so I was really proud to see that on stage. And I was also really proud to see a scene that I hadn't seen before of siblings crossing the river and entering this country. In terms of my future, I see myself on the bench for many years, and I want to make sure that I'm the kind of judge that the community feels they really are getting to know, because that is such an important role to me.
This episode was produced by Lucas Southard and edited by Sofia Palizaca. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Maya Cueva and additional editing by Allison McAdam. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fidel-Holtz. Our intern is Caroline Aguirre. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
This Latino USA episode was made possible in part by funds granted from the Charles H. Revson Foundation. The statements made and views expressed, however, are solely the responsibility of the author. And the Oregon Community Foundation, through our Latino Partnership Program, collaborating with Latino leaders and organizations around the state. More at www.oregoncf.org. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
The world is complicated, and for many of us, history class was a long time ago.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's new history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline, history like you've never heard it before.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the story of untreated severe mental illness and Edward Cordero, the young man who pushed another man to his death off a New York City subway. That's next time on Latino USA.